Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources to order. If you have cell phones and they are on, even if they're not ringing, they do pick up on our new system and cause a problem. So if you turn them off position, it would be great. And with that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2402, and we'll have a short description by our administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2402 would increase the maximum amount of license fees for certain weighing and measuring instruments and devices. It would make additional increases in the maximum fee amount annually for 5 years, starting with licenses issued for periods beginning on or after July 1st, 2009, and establishes maximum license fees effective January 1st, 2014. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. There's no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact, but the statement has not yet been issued.
Okay. And so we'll have Dan Floyd from the Northwest Grocery Association and Katie Koba. We'll come on up to the front. And while they're coming up, I will make a note in case somebody was here. House Bill 2291, which we had scheduled for a work session today, we are not going to hear today. We're going to leave that for some extra work before we do a work session. So you can take that one off the schedule. Okay. Whoever wants to go first?
Yeah, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And with me is Russ Wyckoff, who is the administrator of our Measurement Standards Division. This is not our bill, but what we thought we'd do is just talk a little bit about the program which this bill then funds, and then we can turn it over to Dan, who can go through the bill with you. The Measurement Standards Program, a lot of people are surprised that that is even in the Department of Agriculture, but basically what we have are 30 staff people who are responsible for checking all weighing and measuring devices in the state and making sure they're weighing and measuring accurately. So running from scales, the large scales at railroad terminals or livestock facilities to the scales that are in your grocery store, if you looked at them closely, you would see a little stamp that says, you know, certified by the Measurement Standards Division from the Department of Agriculture. I've given the line often in overview about the department. We make sure that the ping pong balls that are used in the lottery drawings are all standard and equal, so no one is getting an unfair advantage with that. We check as well in this program motor fuel dispensing devices to make sure, number one, that you're getting a gallon when you think you're getting a gallon, and number two, we also check fuel quality in this program. Anything else major that I'm missing? It's a program that is fully funded by fees on the customers, and that's the issue that Dan's going to visit with you about. And I think maybe there I'll just stop and see if there's any questions about the program.
No questions.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Floyd. I represent the Northwest Grocery Association. You should have a graph in front of you right now that looks like this. And that's what I'm going to walk you through. Some of you may remember in 2005 we were discussing fees that dealt with the Food Safety Division. So this is the second session in a row that I'm asking for a fee increase. So I want that on the record so you do know I really did say that. starting on the chart there, if you go to the far left in the white, that's the current fee structure, and you'll see it's the date on there is 05-07. I think it's better just look at that as the current fee structure rather than the year on there. A reference point I will use is 22A on there that has grocery check stands, and you'll see that the current fee is $20. This is the current fee structure, and that it raises $1.75 million annually, or just under $3.5 million for the biennium. If that current fee structure stays in place, if you go down to the grand total there, you'll see the total revenue will be around $4.3 million. And that will allow the Measurement Standards Division to fund 18 FTEs. So that's far below a fully funded program. Now, moving over to the middle column there, the yellow, you'll see a program that would be fully funded by fees. not only be a fully funded program, but also funded solely by fees. So it would include 30 FTE, but the fee increase would be 58% industry-wide. Now, moving back to my reference point there, I said 22A grocery track stand. So you'd see we'd go from $20 to $35, which is actually a 75% increase for a grocery check stand. Now, it's not just for grocers. We don't just have it's not just one fee. It's not just one $35 fee, but a fee on every measurement device within that grocery store. So for some, I believe that could be close to 30 or 40 measurement devices within that store.
Does that include the ones in the produce section as well?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does. Yeah.
As well as the electronic ones.
Chair Roblin, Russ Wyckoff, the Administrator for Weights and Measures. The ones in the produce department are estimating only where you put your produce on, and we have a sticker on that that says for estimating use only. The only scales we license are the ones that are actually commercially where money changes hands.
Okay.
Makes sense.
But is there a fee? I'm sorry, Mr.
Right.
Chair. Is there a fee charge for those estimating only?
No, sir, there's not.
Oh, okay.
That was good. Thanks.
Okay. Let's see. So, yeah, 75% fee increase on that 22A is where I was there. The total increase in fees to fully fund the program with fees would be around $1 million per year, so $2 for the biennium. And like I said, that's a 58% fee increase, and you're probably not surprised that that's not the proposal that I'm asking for. That's not House Bill 2402. House Bill 2402 is in the far right, in the blue there. And what House Bill 2402 would do is raise fee. It'd be a modest fee increase of 15%, and that's an average industry-wide. Back to 22A, you'd see grocery check stand going from $20 to $24, which is a 20% fee increase. Also, what's not on this chart here is that each year for over the next 5 years, the fee would automatically increase 2%. That way, or I guess I should point out that fees haven't been increased for 15 years, so that's why you see a need for a 58% fee increase right now. So instead of coming back 15 years later and asking for a massive fee increase, we can incrementally raise them and keep up with what the program needs.
And the bill does it.
Yes.
And the bill does address that ongoing increase.
Yes, it does. And then, finally, and you may remember, in 2005, with the Food Safety Division, we combined a modest fee increase with general fund support. And that's the same thing that this bill does. To fund 30 FTE, House Bill 2402 would need $1.5 million for the biennium. And I'm open for questions.
Okay. Questions? Looks like you're getting on pretty early.
Actually,
I think you must have clarified it pretty well.
Mr. Chair, it's probably just
McPherson.
My own limitations in absorbing the information we were being given. But so the 58% is that's simply the percentage increase from the 4.3 to 6.3.
Yes.
Right?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the 58% represents the increase in fee revenue from 3.486 there
to
5.497.
Okay, I'm with you there. And
okay.
Then, what's the relationship between that 3.486 line and the 4.292? That is, I see their reserve principal, interest income, other income that are the total that difference. So. So is it that amounts are being drawn down from those sources in order to supplement the 3.486?
That we're determining who's going to speak.
I'm not sure what the question is, sir.
Well, I'm just trying to understand the numbers we have in front of us. I see the total under the current structure, if I could, Mr. Chair, 3.486 million, and then there are some other items here to get up to the reserve, principal, interest income, and other income to get up to the 4.2. So that's how you the total that amount that it takes to administer the program is coming from those other sources. Is that the idea?
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson. I'll try to walk you through it a little, hopefully, clear. The 4.2, what that represents is with no fee increase, with our beginning balance of $600,000, we're estimating at this point to have a beginning balance between $500,000 and $750,000. So our total revenue for the 07-09 without any fee increase would be the 4.3. And what our program costs to run, that program runs about $2.8 million a year. So we actually would be about $2.2 million short without additional fee increases. Our proposal that Dan has down here, with it being entirely fee increase base, raises that additional 2.1 or 2.2 million entirely through fees being assessed to the device owners. His proposal would be asking for 1.5 million in general fund money, which would be 75% of the fee increase that we need to maintain a viable, fully staffed program, and 25% of the increase to come on the device owners. So he would generate approximately $500,000 of biennium through increased license fees and $1.5 million through general fund.
Not an expansion.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I just needed to get walked out again a second time.
And I'll ask that question, too. So the first year of this biennium, there would be no increase.
Okay.
And the second year would be the 15% increase. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And would we have spent down all of our reserves?
Again, Chair Roland, we estimate that on July 1st we would have between $500,000 and $750,000. Okay. And we should have an operating capital of 3 to 4 months. 4 months is about $900,000. So we would already be below what we would like for a beginning capital balance. With no fee increase the following June, we estimate we would run out before the end of the biennium, or the end of that year.
Yeah, that makes sense, too. Have you looked at projections with this 2% increase? Does there ever come a time when there isn't a general fund addition to this?
Mr. Chair, I'm not... I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
Okay.
I know that we could... Maybe we do.
Mr. Chair, maybe I can help clarify. Typically, when we are given budget instructions for building a biennial budget, we're given an inflation rate of around 3 to 5% to build in a biennium. That inflation rate usually does not include any salary increases. So when the legislature approves a salary package, the legislature provides the amount of general fund that's needed to fund positions that are funded with general fund, but other fund programs have to use their revenue source to pay for those salary increases. So I would say that a 2% automatic increase for biennium would probably require the continuation of the general fund support as well, with the automatic increases in that to cover inflation. So.
Okay.
That would be my estimate. We have the same scenario now in our food safety program. Last legislative session, you approved a fee increase, some general fund support, and the automatic 2% increase in the program per year, so 4% of biennium. And right now, we are running the program within that limitation, if you want to call it. But again, we are also getting the general fund continued support in our base budget that was approved last legislative session.
Yes, Representative Mauer.
Sure. Question about your FTEs from 18 to 30. Is the industry agree with that FTE increase?
Chair Roland, Representative Mauer. 1992, we had 18 FTEs, and at that point we had 39,000 licensed devices. And as the population grew, our devices grew. We have over 53,000 licensed devices as of today. In 1998, with the support of industry, we came in and added 10 additional positions. We need to test the devices annually to keep the compliance rate within a respectable number. And so we increased the positions with industry support in 1998 to the 30 FTEs. And what we've done now is, once we realized we had a budget issue, we haven't filled positions, and we're presently operating with 7 positions vacant. and it's reflected dramatically in our results for 2006. We've tested about 10,000 less devices as a result of the lack of positions. And to have a viable program, we need to get back to our 30 FTEs that we're presently allowed by the budget but don't have the revenue for.
So maybe, Mr. Chair, I could jump in. The 18 figure reflects the number of positions we could fund with no fee increase or no additional revenue. So in essence, if that was the route that was chosen, we'd just about cut the program in half, not quite. The yellow column is what is reflected in the governor's recommended budget, and I wanted to make sure you were aware of that. His budget is recommending that the program be funded with fees. And then, of course, the industry's recommendation is a mix of fees and general fund. In our program, when we realized the situation we're in with our revenue, we began at least a year ago working with the industry, doing a complete thorough review of the program, of our revenues, and our expenditures. And so in that process, working with the industry, they review our books and how we do our program. We look for efficiencies. And I think together we would both agree, our emphasis to you is we need a fully funded program. How the mix of funds comes in is ultimately up to the legislature to choose. And I need to emphasize, in particular, given, and Representative Dingfelder is aware of this, the biofuels bill as it's moving, we pick up additional work in that bill in terms of monitoring production sources of biodiesel feedstock, and then assuming we get the mandate that kicks in, then our measurement standards staff are the ones that are going out and checking the biodiesel fuel quality. We can only take on those additional resources if this program is fully funded. If we have something less than a fully funded program coming out of this legislative session, then we would not be able to take up that work. And just depending on what level we're funded, that would determine the kinds of inspection rates that we would conduct.
Following?
Yes, Representative Mo.
Thank you. So I'm assuming July 1st, right, is the start of the fiscal year. So on July 1st, you'll be able to hire seven people. Are there seven people out there that can meet that, or is there a lag time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, typically there is a lag time in terms of hiring the folks. And so while we're budgeted for a certain level, in essence, the way an other funds program work is we receive the fees, and what we don't spend stays as a cash balance within the program.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
If I'm understanding this right, then the proposal in blue is a two-step that holds the fees without any increase in the first year of the next biennium, and then goes applies some increases in the second year of the biennium. I see nodding, so I'm going to follow up with a question. Some of those jumps are not huge, but they are meaningful percentage jumps from the first year. Why wouldn't it be preferable to stage it in within the next biennium to sort of get, you know, instead of applying a, you know, in some cases what looks just eyeballing it like a 20, 30, 40% increase in year two of the biennium, to kind of stage that in?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, this is a lesson that we learned with our food safety bill last session. We have an annual licensing period, and our licenses are the increase would go in effect in July 1st. What happened last session is our budget was not passed until after July 1st, so we had to go out with the existing fee authority that we had, and then last fall we had to go out with a second licensing period to make up the difference because of the new fee increase, and that caused obviously a lot of problems in the industry. So under this scenario, I think what we're saying is we would just keep things as they are for this first renewal period of the year, and then the fee increase would go in place in the second year of the biennium. With the general fund, we can live off the general fund in the first year, and then we live off the fees in the second year, if that makes sense. It's a timing of when the money comes in and when we do our renewals.
Okay. If I could make a comment, it's the only reason to do that, it would seem to me, is because you don't trust us to live up to our target. Get out of here by the end of June. And you can comment on that or not as you wish.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, May 15th is when we actually send out the renewals for the period to come in, and then assuming we have the cash on hand July 1st.
That extra 15 days is a good, you know, a good way to make us feel all better, right? That's good. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, just a comment to make sure is most of the businesses and the small businesses work on a calendar year, too. So by implementing the fees, and we discussed this last session, by implementing the fees, they know in advance, they're able to budget for it, and it's a planned sequence of events versus magically it happened and they weren't prepared for it. And in many cases, some of these do have a lot of weight devices and may, in fact, be low-income businesses.
Any other questions? Well, to this panel? Oh, yes.
Chair Roblin, I want to make sure it's clear that this isn't a grocery proposal. It's an industry proposal.
Yeah, I do understand that.
From the parade of the others coming up behind me, that this is an industry agreement, not a grocery plan. So, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for that comment, too.
Is that why they're doing the rope out back there, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Let's see if you did a good job.
Yeah.
So, John McCauley. Should we have Jim Welch come at the same time? Jim, you might as well come on up. You guys can get along.
I think so.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is John McCauley. I'm here representing the Agriculture Cooperative Council of Oregon. As you might imagine, the co-ops that I represent have much interest in this bill and do support House Bill 2402. The companies I'm talking about are Tillamook Cheese, Norpak Foods, Pendleton Grain Growers, Wilco Farmers, a broad spectrum of agriculture cooperatives. And just looking at the list of devices that you see here, some of my members have most of the devices on this list, at least one of them, and sometimes many of them. So they are significantly impacted by the discussion we're having. We believe that 2402 represents a prudent approach, because there are two beneficiaries of this program. One are the consumers, who are assured that they're protected, and when they buy something, it is the accurate amount. And the other is the industry itself, because it does aid in commerce. When you're dealing with foreign governments, other states, buyers, they are assured that they are receiving what they are actually purchasing. So it is a program that benefits both the public and the industry, and for that reason, I believe, makes sense to have some general fund support for the program. And finally, Mr. Chair, I just want to extend appreciation to the Department of Agriculture for the way they have dealt with the industry in discussing this issue. We have had very frank and open discussions. They have been very forthright with all of the numbers, and it's been a pleasure to work with them under those circumstances.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, committee members, I'm Jim Welch, representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And the Department of Agriculture has done a great job of getting us all together, as John said. He has done a good job of explaining why we support this also. And certainly we certainly believe that it will serve the public purpose and certainly the industry. And we would like to see some general fund money there. And, you know, I was before you last week saying that Department of Ag, we would support taking a look at their overall budget for general fund support increases. So we certainly are on board and appreciate you bringing this forward.
Questions of either? Okay. I'll say thank you. I also did get a note from the Northwest Propane Gas Association, who also supports this bill, and I appreciate that. I think those are... the issue, once we have this in a work session, is going to be this goes to Ways and Means.
Yeah.
And they have to make some decisions. And so Jackie gets a lot of extra work with this bill at some point. Yeah, exactly. So there are no other people signed up to testify on House Bill 2402. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak who didn't get signed up? Yes. Hmm.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Northwest Food Processors Association, and I too want to echo the previous witnesses in support of the legislation and encourage you to move it down to Ways and Means, where we'll have a discussion as to what level of general fund support we will have in this bill. And again, while I didn't particularly, I wasn't on board then, but I can echo the other witnesses. The Food Processors Association really appreciates the Department of Agriculture and bringing them into this process. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. We will close our hearing on House Bill 2402, and then we will be opening a hearing on House Bill 2444. And with that, I will allow our administrator to give a short description.
It's very short. House Bill 2444 would abolish the Oregon Bartlett Pear Commission.
And so we have Kevin
Zielinski. Right.
From the Oregon Bartlett
Pear Commission. Pear growers over here.
I might say why I brought this.
Okay. And I will, before he gets going and while the testimonies come around, we'll let Representative Patty Smith give an explanation of.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank Kevin for coming today, and I'll let him answer all your questions. I brought this bill at their request, and I just am very pleased that we are streamlining. So I'll let him go from there, and I'm glad to sponsor this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Zielinski. I live at 5292 Hazel Green Road Northeast in Salem, Oregon. I'm here today to represent the Oregon Bartlett Pear Commission and the pear industry. I'm the chairman of the commission, and it is our intent at this time to proceed with final stage in this process. It's been about a four-year process of transferring what happens in the Oregon Bartlett Pear Commission to other entities. It is the intent of the growers. Many discussions have been held in this regard, of the Bartlett pear growers specifically, and also of the industry on the whole, the pear industry in the state of Oregon. It would benefit us in the management expense with some consolidation of the other entities involved. And it is a good beginning to the further cooperation of the pear industry and promotional efforts that are unified as we're all working towards the same goal. I would be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative. Let's go.
I think he had his.
No.
Ladies first.
Okay. We'll go with Representative Dinkfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was just, and I see in your testimony that this will streamline the process, but can you explain to us what the new process will be like and who you'll be working with or reporting to?
What has happened is that the Pear Commission's activities have been absorbed into Federal Marketing Order 927, which was already in existence, which handles winter pears and other pears. And it's a collaborative between Washington and Oregon, and that's what the activities and the assessments that are being collected are handled through now that have been handled by the Oregon Bartlett Pear Commission.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Representative Boklas.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a follow-up, because I understand, are we saying the federal government is actually helping and doing something good here?
Representative Boklas, I would say they are helping. By the fact that the organization, through the laws that govern the federal government marketing order structure, is benefiting pear growers of the state.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll just make a comment. You know, last session we made the pear, the state fruit, and on the floor, one of the concerns by one of our representatives, I think it was Representative Lem, was to make sure that it wasn't just the Bartlett pear, that it included all pears, including Asian pears. And he did make that statement on the floor.
He did.
And so I guess this is going on to a larger group that is really all about all the pears, winter pears as well as others, and not just the Bartlett pear group.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And did there used to be other pear commissions besides, or is it only just in the Bartlett group?
The Mr. Chairman, the Bartlett Pear Commission operated for both processed and fresh-packed Bartlett pears. There is another entity under the federal marketing order that has handled winter pears in the past. The if I can add a little input about the size of the industry and the value of it as it regards the state of Oregon's agricultural economy. At this time, Bartlett pears produce are about 58,000 tons in the state of Oregon, representing just short of $20 million of market value. The total pear crop from the state of Oregon is in the area of $63 million for market value. So there is a larger industry beyond Bartlett pears, and this is part of a collaboration of efforts to further the development of that industry by allowing it to have greater potential at the market point.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thanks. Again, Kevin is the only person to sign up. If there's anyone else here that wishes to speak to this bill, seeing none, we will close our public hearing on House Bill 2444, and we will open a public hearing on 2445 in a short explanation.
House Bill 2445 amends the definition of the word charge in the statutes to specify that it does not include any amount received from a public body in return for granting permission to the public to enter or go upon it, the owner's land.
Okay, so we have Al Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No. Thank you, Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Representative Smith for introducing this bill on behalf of the Oregon Hunters Association. In the first paragraph of my testimony today, I plug the Oregon Hunters Association, and since I've done that already with all of you in your offices, I won't continue that on. But the purpose of the bill here today is to talk a little bit about a gray area that exists in our recreational liability statutes. We have currently statutes that we refer to as recreational liability statutes in ORS 105.672 to 700. And the purpose of these statutes is to encourage landowners to open their land to recreational use by the public. The law seeks to advance this purpose by limiting the liability of those landowners for injuries recreationists may suffer while recreating on those lands. This is done in subsection 2 of 0.688, and this subsection provides that the immunities of exist only if the landowner makes no charge for permission to use the land. This bill focuses in on the gray area that has occurred over recent years with the emergence of programs that have come about through agencies such as the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which bring money onto or provide money to landowners to increase habitat or recreational purposes on their land. And the question has become, do the current immunity statutes continue to provide immunity to the landowner if the landowner is receiving a grant to provide recreational opportunities on his or her property? How does that affect that word charge? HB 244 resolves this landowner immunity question by further defining on lines 10 and 11 on page 1 the word charge to say it does not mean any amount received from a public body in return for granting permission for the public to enter on or go upon the owner's land. This will allow for the landowner, if he or she allows someone to recreate on their land, to continue to have that immunity from access. That concludes my written testimony. I was asked a question earlier today about how many landowners have been discouraged by this gray area that exists, and I asked the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they said that last year there were 3 to 5 landowners who decided not to go forth in the Burns area, which affected about 10,000 acres of access to about 10,000 acres, which means we would have had access to recreate on that, those acres. And there have been one or two others in this last year as well. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions of the committee?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all. Next, we'll have Ron Anglin come from ODF&W.
Good afternoon, Chair Roebling, members of the committee. My name is Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I thank you for the opportunity today to be in front of you. Roy Elliker couldn't make it and has asked that I cover everything for them. As has already been stated by Mr. Elkins, the statutes currently are designed to encourage private landowners to allow public access for recreational purposes and woodcutting on their property. And the gray area has arisen in the last few years, primarily associated with our access and habitat program, and we're passing out a flyer on that, as well as with our upland coordinated access program, or UCAP. And the gray area is that we are granting money to a landowner to allow public access, which is something that the statutes encourage us to do, is to gain public access. And we have a statutory drive or a mission within the agency to do that. And we have had landowners that have directly asked us the question, am I protected from liability if we sign up for your program? And so far, what we've been able to tell them is it is a gray area. We think that you're covered, but it really is up to you and your lawyer to decide that. And in recent times, with some of the landowners that are now acquiring lands and willing to participate in the program, they have gone to their lawyers, and their lawyers have said that they do not feel that the statute clearly provides them liability protection. So those landowners that have had that kind of consultation have pulled out of the program. And Mr. Elkins mentioned that we did have some in the Burns area that we lost 10,000 acres of public access, but they were also immediately adjacent to the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and we lost access through those properties to the refuge. We have had several other landowners that were not as far into the process as these were and decided not to move forward with applying for the grants through A&H at all. And we have had assurances from many of those landowners that if the statute was fixed and they were provided with liability coverage, that they would be interested in participating and would come back to the agency seeking to enroll their lands. As an agency, we have made a big push in the last couple of years to gain private land access in large chunks and make some long-term commitments to provide hunters with places to go. And we have specifically looked at trying to gain access to landlocked federal lands or public lands. And these liability questions continue to come up and are of grave concern to us because it is inhibiting our program to some degree. So we are in support of this this amendment, Mr. Chair. And I guess to add to that, under the Upland Cooperative Program, we currently have 100,000 acres of private lands enrolled. And in the Access and Habitat Program, we have, while I state 3.5 million acres enrolled, that did not take into account the 78,000 acres that the board just approved last week. So we have close to 400,000 acres enrolled in A&H program right now for public access. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the response from Mr. Elkins earlier because he anticipated a question I was going to ask based on the conversation we had earlier today. But there's a related question. And I'll put it to you, Mr. Anglin, although Mr. Elkins could respond if need be. Quite aside from whether there are property owners who feel deterred by the possibility of liability, have any property owners actually experienced liability or even a claim, an assertion of liability as a result of allowing public access?
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson, I'm not aware of anything in recent times. I am aware that in the Roseburg area we had a landowner that provided access through his property to the North Umpqua River for taking out and putting in drift boats. There was an injury on his property. Person twisted his ankle in the rocks, sued the landowner, and landowner ended up closing his property down. There was, I think, a slight access fee charged at that point in time. So I'm not aware of anything recently, but the concern is there with landowners today when they do talk to us.
Mm-hmm. So if I could, Mr. Chair, and it's really not a question. It's just that there's a lot of paranoia out there about landowner liability. And if you look at, actually, the history of claims, one would be led to the belief that it's more paranoia than it is real, tangible risk that people are responding to. And I realize that when you're trying to get a program to work, perception becomes reality, but it is more a matter of perception and belief than it is actual experience with lawsuits.
I'll just make a comment in the sense that, you know, in our area in Coos County for hunting, Weyerhaeuser, a lot of the places have let that be open. And they take a lot of liability on their own stuff, campfires, fires. I mean, there's all sorts of things that campers and hunters take with them. And then to add on to that, the issue of liability if they were to hurt themselves or whatever, I think is undue, because it's been a wonderful experience for a lot of people to have the access that's been afforded to them by a lot of these private landowners over the years. And I, for one, am one of those people who feel that we need to continue to have that access. And if this makes them feel more comfortable, even if it is a paranoia, and I think there can be a paranoia regarding that, but when you already have other risks that you're accepting, and then you add one more to the whole thing, it makes it just a little, I would say, frustrating. It makes it easier for them just to say no and lock their gates and end that thing that has been a part of rural life in Oregon for a long time. So I appreciate that the ODF NIB is here asking these questions along with the Hunters Association, because I think we continue to lose those places and those access points. And most of the hunters, at least, understand that when they go on these places that have been open for, they don't have any liability, so they wouldn't have asked the question. I understand that clearly. I think it's sometimes less likely that people who go there to recreate understand that as well, because when they open it up and they go up there in their motorcycles or whatever, those people are more likely to not understand that it was open, the gate wasn't closed, because this liability issue is not on their head. So, anyway, that's just a comment more than anything else from the perspective of a lot of people who live out there and get to take advantage of a whole lot of private land that we would not otherwise have had a chance to. So, anyway.
Question.
Brian, Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, as a follow-up to your comment, too, and I think, and I've experienced it, I own property and large tracts of property, and the challenge comes down is one of the first things the council asks you, and insurance company is it posted? Do you allow public access? So on and so forth like that. And while I would agree with Representative McPherson, I don't think there's a lot of cases where we've been sued. The problem is if you take the best advice of the lawyers, and one says this and one says that every day in a court of law, I think we're actually denying the public access to private property that we would have, because I think a lot of people don't even consider participating in these programs that we're trying to get the public to consider, because their counsel or their insurance company, advises them against it because of the perceived risk. And it again is that case where it's perception more than reality, but, small tract owners with 1,000 or 2,000 acres can't afford even the wraparound insurance policy, let alone to face litigation. So I think this is a good effort to try and expand the program. I don't think it really preserves the program so much, but it's an expansion mode that allows the tools for both the private organizations and Fish and Wildlife to go out and expand public access, which has in fact been the goal of the legislature the last 2 years I've been here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next we have, looks like Dykesel? Oh, it is a K. Okay.
I'll be very quick, thanks to Chair Roblin's discussion. It's almost like you looked over my shoulder for my testimony already. For the record, Mike Dykesel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. You're absolutely correct. There's a whole list of things to manage risk in the forest land anymore. It's not lions and tigers and bears, oh no, anymore. It's meth lab dumping, illegal dumping, car vehicle dumps, a whole list of things. And every landowner has their own level of tolerance for managing their lands and protecting their lands. And so just to be short, all the topics have been discussed already. I think those landowners that do choose to participate in programs such as Access and Habitat are very much relieved by this potential correction. And I think, just to be short, I'll offer our support for House Bill 2445.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Next we have Jim Welch from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
Chair Roblin, committee members, Jim Wells, Oregon Cattlemen Association. The only reason we're down as neutral is we have, as a number of you probably know, the board of directors here today and tomorrow. And Al Elkins with OHA was very good in last week providing their testimony and this bill for us to review. And that's what they're doing. I just chatted with them. We have, I know a lot of our members have participated in Access and Habitat program, and there are a lot of property owners that are larger, have large tracts on the east side. And so this type of liability coverage is definitely a big step in the right direction. And as soon as I find out where they are, I will let the committee know, and certainly the OHA also. Thank you.
Thank you. And Katie Fast, Farm Bureau.
Good afternoon, Chair Roble and members of the committee. Just here, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Just here to add our support to House Bill 2445. Oregon's farms and ranches provide a majority of the habitat for Oregon's wildlife, and many of our members provide hunting opportunities for Oregonians. And you know, we think it's good policy to clarify this uncertainty that's in the law. And I would agree with Representative Boquist's comments that insurance is another big concern, and liability insurance. That is a large expense for Oregon's ranches and farms, is providing liability insurance on our properties. And it is a question that you get asked is regarding access to hunting when you put forward your insurance policies with your agent. And so that is another need besides the lawsuit liability concern in the statute. So we are very supportive of these clarifications, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. That ends the list of people. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak to House Bill 2445? Seeing none, we will close our public hearing on 2445. And we will open a work session on House Bill 2115. And with that, we'll have a short description, and then we'll have a discussion.
House Bill 2115 extends the period for which forest products harvest taxes are imposed and establishes rates for the extended period. This bill would apply the changed harvest tax reporting period beginning on or after January 1st, 2008. There is a revenue impact statement, a fiscal impact statement that's been issued that's in front of you. The bill has a subsequent referral to revenue.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
I'll make a motion to move this House Bill 2115 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to the House Committee on Revenue.
So Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2115 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? As you know, this is one of those that's difficult to know because it has to be assigned numbers before anything really happens, and that takes place on its trek to the floor through revenue. So,
Mr. I think it comes out of revenue and goes away as means.
I think it does, yeah. I think it has a it goes away.
I'll hear this one eventually.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's one of those that takes. So we like to get out early because it has a long ways to go before it gets to fruition here. So any other discussion or questions? Okay. There, those of the opinion that House Bill 2115 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill referred to the House Committee on Revenue by a prayer reference will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call roll.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Gokas?
No.
Representative Flynn?
Excused.
Representative Ningfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Aye. So having received the required majority, it's declared passed. And we will close our work session on 2115. Again, as I explained earlier, we are not hearing testimony or having a work session on 2291. So anything, any questions or anything for the committee? Then we will close our session for House Ag and Natural Resources.
No, you do need a carrier.
You don't need a carrier, do you?
Yeah.
I couldn't remember.
Yeah,
it's like so confusing.